We bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of the show. Miguel is my engineer. Charlene Dahl is my research woman. Hello, Charlene.
Good evening, everyone.
We are speaking tonight with Galen Lee. She is a violinist, a songwriter, and an disability advocate. Thanks for joining me, Galen.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Sam. It's nice to be with you again.
Yeah. So I want to start out with those who don't know you. I can't imagine who don't, you know, people that don't know you. But now that you're so well known, can you talk a little bit about, I mean, the first time that I was introduced to you was with the Tiny Desk concert that you did for NPR. But you weren't always a musician and you used to teach. So can you talk a little bit about your previous life and how you got introduced to the Tiny Desk concert?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I started performing, you know, I played orchestra all the way through high school, and then I switched to folk music in college. But then in college, I also started performing. And so I was performing a lot, but you're right, I was teaching fiddle lessons by day and then doing shows at night, like a few times a week or whatever. But I heard about the Tiny Desk contest because a couple of my fiddle students actually sent me an email with a link to like read about it. And then one of my best friends also sent the link. And on the third time, you know, you're kind of like, wow, third time. I feel like I should probably look at this. So I kind of started reading about it. And I was hesitant at first because it was a contest. So the concert series, you know, they kind of curate that. But then once a year, they have a contest where anyone can enter. And I was hesitant because sometimes contests are, I don't know, just kind of like all hype, or maybe they have the right to exploit your stuff forever and ever. But I looked at the rules and they were pretty cool. I was like, oh, this is actually just a cool contest. So I entered about a week later because it was kind of closing soon. My friend who told me about it is one that filmed the video for it.
So was it after that? I mean, what was it like when you won that contest for you? Was it after that you just decided that you were going to be like a total serious performer?
Yeah, I mean, it was a big deal for me because I had been playing, you know, I think I took music pretty seriously. Like the reason I switched, I was an insurance agent before I was a fiddle teacher, but I knew
what a switch.
I know it's like another life or whatever, but I knew I wanted to do music full time, but I didn't know that, you know, like playing shows full time is a pretty intense and like difficult way to make a living. But after the Tiny Desk, because it was a national contest and I had never had any national press, I started getting requests to play and speak all over the country. And so that's when I decided, well, if I was ever going to try touring, this would be the time, right? Because when else am I going to have this kind of push? So then my husband and I decided that we would try it out, but we liked it, so we kept going.
So you were born with a disability called osteogenesis imperfecta. For those who don't know what that is, can you explain what that is and how it affects how you play the violin?
Totally. Well, so the disability I have, the like layman's term for it is brittle bones disease, and it really just means that my collagen, it's a genetic disorder, the collagen isn't formed the same way as most people's. And I'm the only person in my family with it. It was a spontaneous genetic mutation. So it makes my bones more fragile. Mine are actually pretty sturdy for someone with, you know, with my disability. But I still broke probably 16 or so bones growing up. And my spine is very curvy with scoliosis and stuff. So anyways, before I was born, my arms and legs, both, all of them broke in utero and then healed in utero, where they're kind of at 90 degree angles, like kind of where the elbow and then you would be, they're permanently bent. And so when I wanted to play music in orchestra, I wasn't able to hold the violin on my shoulder the way that you should or normally do, I guess. And so I got lucky in that the teacher was willing to kind of experiment with me, and we came up with the method where I play my violin up and down like a tiny cello, because the cello was also just too big for my arm span. So we kind of made up this new way of playing, and I've met a couple of people now who do it like that, so it's not completely unheard of, but it wasn't something I was familiar with, and it worked really well, and I just kind of kept going and learned alongside my peers with that different technique.
And do you still play with that technique today?
Oh, yeah. Yep, I play it upright. Like, when I do visual descriptions at shows, I always say I have my violin upright in my wheelchair like a tiny cello, because that's what I think of it as, is like a little cello. And then I hold my bow like an upright bass player, which won't mean anything to anyone unless they know what I'm talking about. But I hold my bow a little bit differently, too, because of the way my hand is angled because of those bends. I couldn't hold it like a cello player does. I have to hold it underhanded.
Gotcha. Galen, you did a TED Talk, which I thought was really awesome when I saw it, on sexuality and people with disabilities. And how did that come about, that you got to do that?
It was, I just got asked, and the theme was Mind the Gap, which is kind of like living in the gap. And that's the idea that came to me. I had written a big paper about that concept in a more academic way during college, and it's something that really makes me excited to talk about. So, yeah, that's what I chose as my topic. I had never done one of those before, so it was a harrowing experience.
You talk a little bit about, in that discussion, about society standards, and that you feel like it was easier for you because you didn't feel like the standards fit you. And so it kind of made it easier for you to do what you wanted and be who you wanted. Can you talk a little bit about that? And does that still apply today?
Yeah, I mean, that realization that, especially around sexuality and beauty standards, I felt growing up with such a visible disability that, like, no matter what I did, it was going to be very obvious that my body was different. Like clothes or weight loss or hair were not going to impact the fact that I used a wheelchair. My arms were bent, you know what I mean? And then I was really small. And so I just kind of, like, it became kind of like white noise, the like advertising you see. It's not like I didn't care at all how I looked, and I think everybody probably does on some level want to present themselves in a way that makes them feel good, but it wasn't based on normative standards. It was based on like what I liked, basically. And so I think it does still apply. I think actually what the big realization of the TED Talk and the paper that I wrote was that it looks like disabled people are the people that can have this realization. Like, if you're left out of society's norms, then you can be free to discover who you are. But really, everybody can do that. And so I think it's helped me kind of, like, it's not like I don't fall prey to that. And I think we all do sometimes, like, comparison.
Right.
Comparison, sure. On any standard, right? Like, how am I doing as a musician? You know, like, how do I compare to this person? But
right.
It kind of reminds you that those are all basically artificial, like designed for capitalism. Like anything where you're comparing yourself against another person really isn't in your best interest most of the time. So it just kind of helps bring you back to reality, I think, once you have that realization that a lot of society standards are not actually there to help you. They're there to make people money, basically, like the cosmetic industry or, you know, plastic surgery or whatever it is that people do spend money on to fit in. It's not there to like help. It's really not there ultimately to make you feel more fulfilled. It's there to make people money. And so when you realize that, you can take what you like. For example, I very much like brightly colored flower hair clips, but I don't necessarily care about brand names because, again, it's all part of a scheme to keep us buying stuff, basically.
Right. Sometimes companies, it seems, especially lately, I mean, they act like they're trying to do more with pictures of people with disabilities in their magazines. And do you feel like that's an honest try, or do you think they're just doing it to I mean, I wonder how you think that that's really helping people with disabilities be included.
Yeah, I have so many mixed feelings about that. It's funny that you ask that. I think that inclusion is pretty much always good, right? Like normalizing disability and having it be visible in our culture is super duper duper important because people don't think about us unless they have a reason to, unless they have exposure to it, I guess. But the thing that I think is like kind of ironic is I think we should all not be advertising for like giant companies. But I guess it's good to have inclusion, but on the other hand, part of me is like, man, this corporate like advertising stuff, is it really in anyone's best interest? But I guess I still think that if it's your passion, like, I'm a musician, right? Some people really genuinely get a lot out of fashion, and I'm not there to like shame them or like they really, really enjoy makeup. So like, yes, if you are gonna have products being marketed, then yes, you should include people with disabilities. Now, do I think that's like the ultimate, I don't love it, but I'm not gonna say that it's not important to have inclusion because I still think that it is.
The song that we opened to with the show today was called I Wait, which is really a very powerful song to me. And, if you listen to the lyrics, anybody who listens to them will understand. Can you talk a little bit about the place you were in when you wrote that song and where it came from and what it means to you?
That song in particular was about during the healthcare debates when they were talking. This is back maybe 2018, probably, I think, when they were talking about gutting Medicaid, and John McCain famously put his thumb down and stopped the bill from passing or whatever. It was very, very close, right? And at that time, I was extremely frustrated that when you would read articles about who it would harm, if we destroyed Medicaid, it almost never mentioned people with disabilities. And I was like, what? That is like ridiculous because that is the group that will
A
be, I
huge
mean,
portion,
a huge portion of the group. It's not everybody, right? I know a lot of people rely on Medicaid, but it was such a big deal to the disability community, and it was like not being in the field of awareness for most of the reporting about it. Like people didn't even think about the disability side of it. They talked about a lot of other areas, and they're all important, right? So you can't leave disability out. And so I wrote that song from a place of extreme frustration with just like, yeah, we need a seat at the table, but on the other hand, you have to still be willing to work with people where they're at, kind of, unfortunately. Even if you feel like storming away and writing everybody off, at the end of the day, unless you're willing to like, be the bigger person or just keep going, you're not going to end up achieving what you want. You know what I mean? So that song is that, like, the frustration that comes with that reality of like always having to be the one that's like pushing dialogue forward, even though you're tired of it. And luckily, shortly after that song was written, and not because of the song, it just so happened on the timeline that all those awesome advocates started getting arrested and their senator's office, and people started finally talking about disability in relation to Medicaid, and I felt like at least it was getting some awareness that it deserved. But this song was written before that stuff started happening, so it was just a place of frustration, I guess.
I still feel like there's not as big of a push, and I don't know if it's that there's that people with disabilities aren't advocating like they used to, or used to hear about more protests. I know you get, different groups, races, or ethnic groups that are that protest, and the LGBT that protest, but I feel still like people with disabilities are still kind of, I don't know if hidden is the right term, but they're just not out there as much as I'd like to see. Do you see this, or is this, am I just not in the right place?
I agree. I don't know. I mean, I feel like it's a mixed bag. Like, I think there's more general awareness being raised around disability than I've seen. I'd say in the last 5 years, like, you know, major festivals are starting to talk about disability inclusion in the music realm. The music realm is the one that I've been most active in, right? Like accessibility in the arts. And that is starting to change. But I see what you're saying, that like, where's the radical activism? I personally, my personal belief, and you know, we don't have to agree obviously on everything, but my personal belief is that I think radical activism is 100% necessary when it's like a, this has to happen right now, or we've been trying forever and it's just not changing. I understand where radical activism comes in, but the thing that I'm working towards in my own work as an artist advocate is actually shifting the cultural narrative. So instead of having to raise awareness by like chaining yourself to a bus, which was so, which was so important though, like what Judy Heumann did and stuff, all that stuff is like the blocking the buses. I mean, they needed to do that because nobody was listening to them. Like they could not get coverage to save their lives. You know what I mean? Like they needed to do something really inflammatory in order to get anyone to pay attention. But I think we're in a little different place now where my goal, instead of having to do that, is to make people realize that we're a valuable part of the culture so that they're actually like excited about trying to make things better, so that it's not like you're forcing them or you're guilting them or you're shaming them, but you're able to say, look, I know you didn't mean it because you didn't know any better, but now you know. And like, what are you going to do to fix it? And that won't work in every situation. Like, I will be honest, like I kind of think in the case of Medicaid, for example, we probably will always have to be doing sit-ins until culture really, really shifts. But on other things, the goal is to say, look, we all at this point in our lives in America acknowledge that it's important to support diversity. And if you do that, if you say that, you have to include disability and then make it more of a like, don't you want to be on the right side of history, rather than like, and now I'm going to chain myself to a bus. But I think they're both they're both important, and I don't think we should downplay any of them. But I think the ultimate shift that I want to see has a lot more to do with internalized shifting of like what the value of disability is. And you're not going to need to chain yourself to a bus when people finally recognize that you actually have inherent value. So like, I think that's where the shift is, I hope, heading. And it feels like that from the arts world, but maybe not in every other field. And I think, and like somebody told me a long time ago that you need all sorts of advocates, because where you're effective, your work might not be effective in another area. And like, we just kind of all need to do what moves us and like what we're excited about. So I think you're right, but I do think you're right. Like, we can't grow complacent, because even though I know we've come a long ways, and largely in part, like thanks to Judy Heumann and all the people that she organized, we've come a long ways, but our rights are on very, you know, tenuous ground. Like, there's still only, you know, you reverse a few laws and we're back where we started, you know, so we can't get like comfortable and say the time for activism is over, because I don't believe that's true either.
In your performing, you use what's called a looping pedal. Can you describe what that is and how it works?
Yes, I can. So it's a metal box that is a recording device, and I put it in my wheelchair, kind of like under my left leg, and it's got two buttons. One you hold down the whole time you're playing when you want it to be recording. So like, if I want to start a loop, I'll push down and hold it until I want the second layer to start. And then when I let go of the button, it automatically starts looping what it just recorded. And so in this way, you can build up, like, I think my pedal does around 12 layers of sound. So you can build up like a whole bunch, but you can kind of choose when to build and when to just let it play. And it's really fun. It's what's allowed me to do things with my violin solo that I wouldn't be able to do otherwise. And it also kind of allows me to experiment with harmonies and stuff. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. Do you use any other pedals in performing?
I am a technological, I lack in those skill areas. So I have this pedal that I have can do reverse and octaves, and I use those sometimes. So like it can reverse the melody line and it sounds really cool. And then it can drop down to like a lower octave and sound really slowed down and low. And then I do have like a reverb pedal and a distortion pedal, but I don't use them a whole lot. That is something that's really fun about violin and technology, is that there's like a billion things you can do. Like there's so many things that I could learn, and so I'll never be bored, basically.
Have you tried anything with an electric violin?
No, the closest I've come is I did buy, like a few years right before the pandemic, I bought a 5-string. So it's got a low C string. So it kind of, like the whole cello vibe, it's got like the low, but it's very different positions where the bow goes. So I'm not very good at it. So I haven't really performed with it yet, but that's something I really want to get better at because I really think it sounds cool.
And with your songwriting, like, where does it come from? Are you able to do it just wherever you want, or do you need to kind of have a specific atmosphere? Does it come easy? Tell me a little bit about your songwriting.
Yeah, that's a good question. I feel like songs kind of bubble up from your subconscious when you're relaxed, but it has to be like something that you've processed already. So a lot of times, like I haven't written a lot of songs about COVID yet because I think I'm not quite through processing it, you know? Like, and so they always feel spontaneous, but if you think back, it's stuff that you've thought a lot about, but your subconscious like kind of shoves it out in a new way later. You know what I mean? And then once I have a spontaneous idea, which is usually in the bathtub or like on a walk or sometime when you're relaxed and not really thinking about anything, I'll have an idea, but then I can kind of sit down and work with it and like rework it and change it and edit it and then like push to write more of it later. But you need that original spark, I think, before, like even for the Macbeth soundtrack, I had the main themes came to me in the bathtub, and then all the cues, like there were, you know, 50 cues, and they all got built up and they were all very different from each other, but they all came out of that one thing where I thought of these four themes. So you need the inspiration to strike, or at least I do. And then you can build off of it in a lot of different ways.
Galen, if you could perform with anyone, who would it be?
Oh my goodness. I don't know. I'd love to meet like Itzhak Perlman or Yo-Yo Ma, do something with them. That'd be so cool. I always wanted to see Jack White perform. I've never seen him live. He's like fascinating to me. It'd be fun to do something with him. I honestly always try to hold those ideas with a light hand because it seems like once you start trying to force stuff to come, it doesn't work. But I just like to be open to whatever comes out. But those two would be really fun to meet, and Jack White, and I don't know who else. Like I loved Simon and Garfunkel growing up, so maybe Paul Simon or something. That'd be fun. Who knows?
Who are the artists that you look to now when you're listening?
I have the weirdest eclectic tastes ever. So I grew up, you know, as I said, like Simon and Garfunkel, Wilco, the Decemberists, Lucio Milk Hotel. And then as I got older, I really got into like Duluth artists like Charlie Parr and, of course, Alan Sparhawk of Low. And then when we started traveling, I started meeting artists that I really love to listen to, like Wheelchair Sports Camp. Kaylin Heffernan is a hip hop artist out of Denver who's amazing. She has the same disability as me. And Ben DeLaCour, he's from Nashville. He's an amazing songwriter, probably one of the best. And Jess Klein is an amazing songwriter. So just like kind of meeting people on the road. And then when I'm home by myself, to be honest, I pretty much just listen to like big band music or Celtic folk music, like the Corries, the Scottish duo.
Oh, that's
the
funny.
Corries.
Okay.
Like I'm kind of way back in time on my own, but I do like to be get introduced to new stuff. You know, here, and I got to do a better job at seeking it out because I love my old music. That's kind of my jam.
Yeah. Well, now that you're, much more known as a performer with a disability, obviously that opens doors for you, and hence why you can, I feel like you can use your advocacy a lot to make people aware of things. Do you ever find that it makes some doors harder to open because of that?
It's a mixed bag. I think that the world, the grass is always greener everywhere else, right? But the thing that is, still difficult is that I don't play at inaccessible venues anymore, right? And I'm really trying to get venues to see the importance of getting an ASL interpreter and captioning at all my shows. And it limits where I can do stuff because now that there's COVID stuff, I really don't want to become inaccessible to immunocompromised people. Right. So I've been trying to have masks at all my indoor shows required. And that's really tricky right now to get places on board with that. Some of them are The Hook and Ladder recently was really cool about it, and that was awesome, and I love them. So there's it's harder when you have goals for where you want to see things go because it's not really there yet, so you're kind of imposing these limits on yourself. But I think it's important to set an example and to be but what I want to see, what would make that easier is if big acts from Minnesota or the Midwest or the national scene also started saying, yeah, I want to have captioning at all my shows and ASL, and I'm not going to play at a venue where a disabled artist couldn't perform. Recently I was talking to I'm not going to name names, but a regional artist who's pretty well known. Mm-hmm. And he was saying that none of the venues they were at, I would have been able to perform in, right? Because I wouldn't have been able to get to the stage. And it's maybe that's part of the solution is a band as big as yours could say, we're not going to play at these venues because a disabled performer couldn't get on. And he wasn't quite getting what it's not there yet. We're not there yet. And I'm okay, well, that's what needs to happen next. Because I think the doors, and then there's still the idea, I think, in pop culture that disability is somehow a niche thing where you only will resonate with other disabled people. And I just don't think that's true because, A, that hasn't been my experience on the road. Lots and lots of different kinds of people come to my shows. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that my music only resonates if you have a disability. But the other part of it is, yes, 26% of Americans have some sort of disability, but almost 100% of Americans know and love someone with a disability. So it's not a niche, it's not a niche thing to have disability be part of your experience, even if it's not direct, you know what I mean?
Right.
So
right.
I think that changing the narrative about disability, I don't always have to talk about disability. I can just make music. But I would like to be promoted the same way as other artists, and I think a lot of times the only things, and not in this interview, but I'm talking about when I release albums, mm-hmm. a lot of times all of the articles are about my disability, and it's let's just talk about the music for a little bit,
right?
So you're kind of addressed in a different way, I guess, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, but I do agree that it is true, right? It's one thing for you to say, well, I'm not going to even perform at a place that won't be accessible or won't try to, move towards being accessible. But I do think that there's a whole different thing about when people decide, well, I can get on the stage, so why should I boycott that?
Yeah.
Exactly. And it does say a lot. I think that it changes the terrain significantly if people really start thinking above themselves and thinking for the whole and say,
yeah,
this is not just about, a person or a select few. This is about the whole, right? Usually, if you look back with the disability changes any almost all changes that have been done. I mean, you can start with curb cuts and elevators that were good for someone with a disability have been good for the whole. So I really think it's going to take a lot of people saying, look, this is just going to have to be the norm, where you start changing, you know, how your venue is instead of the exception.
Exactly. Like, I think that's why bigger artists taking that on for themselves would be so impactful, because I bet you'd only need like 20 or 30 big names to be like, this is the new standard, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And it takes a lot longer if it's just me out there slogging by myself. I mean, I'm not the only one. Like, that's what's been great about Ramped, recording artists and music professionals with disabilities that I helped to found last year, is because you realize there are a lot more people out there than I knew doing the same stuff I do, but we just haven't been well publicized, so we don't know each other, you know? We're getting to know each other now.
So talk a little bit about Ramped. You started that, and are you the vice president now, or how's that work? What is, tell us all a little about that.
Yeah, no, that's cool. During the pandemic, there were an increasing number of panel discussions by some big art organizations like the National Endowment for the Arts and stuff about accessibility in the arts. And I kept being on these panels with somebody named Lachi, L-A-C-H-I, and she's a Black EDM artist who's also blind, from New York City.
Cool.
And we got to know each other kind of like by being on all these panels. And then one of the days she called and said, you know, I want to start an organization called Ramped, Recording Artists and Music Professionals with Disabilities, that would kind of help support professional artists, like not just people who like to play for fun, but people who are trying to make a living doing music and like have that be their main career, because I don't think there's resources for them, which I already... It's funny because I had always thought that, but I was like, well, who the heck? I don't have time to start that. But then she asked if I would co-found it, and I agreed. And so I was vice president for the first like 18 months. And now I'm just, a co-founder / I go to all the meetings and stuff like that. But because I've been working on some larger behind the scenes projects. But it's such a cool thing. There's, we decided we would make a website that has a database. It's just rampd.org. There's a database now, so you can search. We have like 60 professional disabled artists on there right now, and we're going to grow every year, I think. But like, if you are looking to work with, for example, a disabled sound engineer or a disabled PR person or a disabled, composer or songwriter, you want a Latin artist who is, we have so many different, we have techno, we have all sorts of, there's lots and lots and lots of different genres represented. You can just go and actually read about them and listen to their music and then contact them to hire them. Because the biggest thing we heard is that we kept getting asked to do all these events, and we kept saying people need to hire more disabled artists. And a lot of people would say, well, we don't know anyone but you. And it's like, well, there's definitely more of us out there. So this is a way to kind of be like, look, you go find them and then hire them and then get to know them and get familiar with their music. So if anyone's interested in kind of seeing who's out there, Ramped is, it's not everybody in the world with a disability who's performing, but it is certainly a big chunk of active performing artists and stuff.
That's really cool. And when I read about that, I had no idea they existed. So that is really cool. Now,
yeah, it's really fun.
Advertised here.
Yay. Yeah. I just actually today had a meeting with someone where I was like, well, I am not available, but here are four people that would be great and you should go contact them. So that's kind of one of the main points. And then we're doing advocacy and accessibility consulting. So we worked with the Grammys last year and this year to try to make their on-screen and off-screen stuff more accessible. So we've been doing other stuff too, but the database to me is a very practical way to start, getting some of this equity that we talk about so much being done in a practical way.
As a disability advocate, are you currently supporting any bills that are going that are happening right now for people with disabilities?
Actually, there is one in Minnesota specifically. So it's a state legislator bill that would create a pot of money where small nonprofit arts organizations could apply and use the money specifically for ADA compliance to get up to code. I'm trying to think, I wish I knew the exact bill number, but Jennifer McEwen is the person who is kind of heading that up. And it was kind of initiated during Save Our Stages. People were saying, oh, we've got all this extra money, but still nothing's being done about accessibility. So that is one of the reasons. If I can find it, I will let you know. Yeah.
All right. That'd be great. You're doing a talk coming up and a small performance in Minnesota. Not very far. Like Friday, I believe. Can you tell us a little bit about when that's happening?
Yeah, it's a thing called a convocation. Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota does this talk every Friday. They have a different person come in. And so I'm going to be there from 10:50 to 11:50 in the morning at the Skinner Chapel at Carleton College. And I'm going to give a speech about disability culture. And then I'm going to play a few songs at the end. And then I think there's like an open, you know, chance to say hello or whatever afterwards. And I'm really looking forward to it.
So do you know, will it be streaming?
I think they are recording it. I don't think it streams live to the best of my knowledge. But I believe there will be a recording of it available afterwards.
Okay.
Yeah. And I did this one a couple, like maybe 3 years ago on a slightly different topic. At Carleton. So it's a big, huge, like church type building, you know, their Skinner Chapel is huge. So, yeah, if you can make it live, that'd be cool. Otherwise, I'm sure I'm pretty sure there's some kind of recording available later.
What do you like to do when you're not performing?
That's a good question. I love to go on walks. We live, in Duluth and I'm obsessed with Lake Superior. So I try to get out and see the lake as many days as I can. I really like to read a lot. We have a pet bunny who is really cute, but he eats everything in the house. But he's very cute, and so I like being with him and being with family and friends. And then I took up watercolor painting during the pandemic, but I really enjoy that. So I try to do that every now and then. I'm not super talented or anything, but it's a really fun, fun relaxation thing. And it's kind of fun to, you know, push yourself creatively, I think.
What is coming up next for you as an artist?
I'm really excited because I am mixing the soundtrack. So for Macbeth. So in April of 2022, so just about a year ago, I was out in New York City. I had recorded and then arranged a pre-recorded score to Macbeth on Broadway with Daniel Craig and Ruth Negga. And so I get to release that music now as a soundtrack, and I'm going to release like the version I had in my head. You know, a lot of things get changed around for a live show,
right.
And they're not all my decisions. So like, this is the version that when I made the music originally, what I wanted to hear, and I'm really excited to release it. There's some other Minnesota artists on there playing instruments. Jeremy Yilvesacker is on guitar. Al Church is on drums. And Dave Mailing is on keyboard and synth. And then it was recorded and mixed by Jake Larson in Duluth. So it's going to be a fun album to release. And then I'm working on a memoir. I've been writing. That's going to be a while. It's going to be a while. It's always longer than you think. But it's been a really good experience to try to learn, you know, the techniques of writing in a more serious way. It's been really fun.
You must come on and talk about it when you are ready.
Yeah, I know. I'm really hoping. I've done some of the actual chapters, and I have the book proposal almost ready to send out. And then hopefully I'll get a publisher after that. There's an agent who's going to send it out, and hopefully there'll be a good a good announcement in the future about publication.
When you're performing, what is your favorite song to perform?
It's always the most recent song. So there's a song in Macbeth at the very end of the show called Perfect. I really like playing that one a lot. And then there, another one called The Long Way Around is a kind of a more recent tune that's really fun for me to play. But I don't know. It kind of varies. I mean, there's a fiddle tune called Metsäkukia. It kind of sounds like the apocalypse. It's a traditional Finnish tune, but with the looping pedal, it really amps it up. So that's a really fun one to play. I don't know. It changes, though, you know, with your mood.
Yeah. So I just want to kind of go out on talking a little bit about the whole idea of normalizing disability culture. Can you say a little more about that?
Yeah. You know, the more disabled artists I meet and the more I think about disability and our experience and the artists that I've gotten to know, it's just really evident, increasingly evident, that disability, the music that you make or the art that you paint or the way that you write, if you're disabled, it affects how you see the world, right? And how you process things and how you think about things. And so you create art from a different place, not like different good or bad, just different, right? And so disability culture to me is acknowledging that your life experiences can shape the culture that you create. So disability, instead of always thinking of negative terminology like, you know, suffering from or barriers or victims, or, you know, like that language, I think disability culture can kind of reclaim the idea that disability makes us creative and adaptable and resilient and like innovative and in a way, and so that our culture is, and then, you know, we overcome oppression. We, you know, we're thinking about the good of everyone. A lot of our, as you said before, a lot of the things that benefit disability truly benefit everyone. And I think we're all pretty much aware of that, you know, like we're fighting for equality for all people. And so disability culture is just this idea that we don't have to think of disability as like, well, the way I accommodate it is by building a ramp so that I don't get sued. It's like, no, I want to celebrate the contributions of disabled people, and I want to make it possible for that to happen. And so getting on board and becoming more accessible and more inclusive is how you do that.
You know, not that you never had this, but you don't come off as an angry person to me. And I think having a disability, I mean, let's face it, you go through a lot of rejection, a lot of, there's a lot of, you know, prejudice in regards to not getting a job all the time or not, you know, like you talked about, not having a relationship or not maybe being able to get the family you wanted or many, many things, even into the medical things like having doctors that speak to you as like a real person. how did you escape that? I mean, how did you kind of turn yourself into this fairly positive person?
You know, I think that there's two things that really have shaped how I process this stuff. Because, I mean, I get angry. I mean, I think we all get frustrated with where society is at more than anything and how far behind it feels, you know, and how we're always pushing uphill. And that gets really old. But there's two or three things. The first thing is that I really do believe that disability simply highlights what's already universal. So like, if I'm fighting for this, it might look like I'm fighting just for disabled people, but in reality, like, I just know that the world will be better when we do this stuff for everyone. And so it's like, let's just keep going, I guess, you know, like we just gotta do it, because it's actually just the best course of action, no matter what. And then the other thing is that, you know, disability progress that we can make really will help the next generation. Like, I want to live in a world where people who are disabled, kids that are disabled, don't have to do all the stuff that I do just to book a gig. You know what I mean? Like, I want it to be better for them. And that's a motivating factor for me. And then the last thing is, I'm a spiritual person. And so I just think that, like, ultimately, you know, we're here to learn how to love better. And it's one, like, you know, in the Bible, and I don't exclusively read just the Bible. Like, I've read a lot of different texts, but, like, the thing that stands out is, like, it's easy to love people who are kind to you, but the true test of love is, like, how do you act when people aren't kind to you? Because that's actually, like, I mean, there's this verse in the Bible about, like, you know, even the tax collectors are nice to the people who are nice to them, basically. Like, anyone can be nice to someone who's nice to them. A true test of character is, like, how do you act when the chips are down, when people, when things aren't going your way? And I'm not, a saint. Like, I certainly don't always do a good job of that. But I think overall, it's a motivating thing for me to try to learn, like, you know, how to make progress. And I think we'll get there faster if we can try to maintain our optimism and our sense of joy, because who, like, would you want to work with somebody who is super crabby? You know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
It's just, like, logically, I think it makes sense. And spiritually, it makes sense to me to just really try to be the change in a way, even when it's not easy, because it's actually the most important when it's not easy to do that.
We're going to leave with this song called, Breathe, You Are Alive. I really like this song. And actually, it was really cool. And I think you did this with your husband, Paul, right?
Yeah, I did. That's so that fun. Was,
how did that come about?
That was totally spontaneous. The recording engineer, you know, I was doing the poem and he's like, you know what? I think Paul should read part of it. And we're like, oh, that's a cool idea. So we did it and I like it. It turned out really fun.
Yeah, you both did a very good job. I really enjoyed that. Can you talk a little bit about where that came from?
Yeah, that poem is something I wrote kind of at a point when I was feeling stretched out too thin and just kind of realizing that, you know, you can take time to just breathe and be present, and that ultimately that's, again, it's like that's kind of ultimately what matters, right, is being present.
Right.
So. Yeah, and it was really cool to be able to record that with Paul.
Galen, I really appreciate you coming on, and good luck with your future stuff. And thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're incredibly pulled upon, so I really appreciate you doing this.
Well, I really appreciate you. I'm so glad this show exists, and thank you for all you do. And yeah, and I hope to run into you again sometime.
Great. You've been listening to Disability and Progress. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. My name is Sam and I'm the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research person. Miguel Vargas engineered this show. Thank you to Aaron, who is my podcaster. We've been speaking with Galen Lee about her advocacy and songwriting. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. If you want to hear us, you can hear us on our podcasts. This show will be archived for 2 weeks. And if you want to be on my email list, you can email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. Thanks so much for listening.
KFAI.org.